troops to the more heavily reinforced Fort Donelson, 12 miles away. The remaining troops surrendered. "Fort Henry is ours," Grant telegraphed Halleck in the terse, straightforward style that would become his trademark. "I shall take and destroy Fort Donelson on the 8th." Though a severe rainstorm delayed the eastward march to Donelson, Grant remained confident. Writing to his sister, he assured her that her plain brother, however, has as yet had no reason to feel himself unequal to the task. "This was not a boast," he said, "but a presentiment that proved accurate a few days later when he surrounded the rebel forces at Fort Donelson and began his successful assault. After many had died, the Confederate commander, Kentucky native General Simon Buckner, proposed a ceasefire and appointment of commissioners to settle terms of capitulation. On February 16th, Grant telegraphed back the historic words that would define both his character and career. No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender can be accepted. Buckner and 15,000 Confederate soldiers were taken prisoner. More than 1,000 troops on both sides were killed, and three times that number wounded. It was a most bloody fight, a young Union soldier told his father, so devastating to his company that despite the victory, he remained sad, lonely, and downhearted. Only 7 of the 85 men in his unit survived, but the flag was brought through. The North was jubilant upon receiving news of Grant's triumph at Donelson, the first substantial Union victory in the war. 100-gun salutes were fired in celebrations across the land. The capital city was quite wild with excitement. In the Senate, the gallery rose en masse and gave 3 enthusiastic cheers. Elaborate plans were made to illuminate the Capitol's public buildings in joint celebration of the double victory and George Washington's birthday. The day after Grant's victory at Donelson, the president signed papers promoting him to Major General. Lincoln had been following the Western general since he had read the gracious proclamation Grant issued when he had marched into Paducah, Kentucky, the previous fall. "I have come among you not as an enemy," he told the Kentuckians, "but as your friend and fellow citizen." Reports that Grant had taken the field with only a spare shirt, a hairbrush, and a toothbrush made comparisons between Western hardihood and McClellan's Eastern luxury inevitable. It was well known that 6 immense 4-horse wagons had arrived at McClellan's door to carry his clothes and other items to the front. Fort Donelson's capture provided the Union with a strategic foothold in the South. After a ghastly battle at Shiloh 2 months later left 20,000 casualties on both sides, the Union would go on to secure Memphis and the entire state of Tennessee. These victories would soon be followed by the capture of New Orleans. The country's exultation at Grant's victory at Donelson found no echo in the White House. Willie's condition had grown steadily worse since the White House ball, and Tad, too, had become ill. It is believed that both boys had contracted typhoid fever, likely caused by the unsanitary conditions in Washington. The White House drew its water supply from the Potomac River, along the banks of which tens of thousands of troops without proper latrines were stationed. Perhaps because his constitution had been weakened by his earlier bout with scarlet fever, Willie was affected by the bacterial infection more severely than his brother Tad. He grew weaker and more shadow-like as the debilitating symptoms of his illness took their toll. High fever, diarrhea, painful cramps, internal hemorrhage, vomiting, profound exhaustion, delirium. Tending to both boys, Mary almost wore herself out with watching, Commissioner French observed. She canceled the customary Saturday receptions and levees. For Lincoln, too, it was an agonizing period. Nicolay reported that the president gave pretty much all his attention to his sons. But the grim business of conducting the war could not be avoided. Slipping in and out of consciousness, Willie would call for his friend, Bud Taft, who sat by his bedside day and night. Late one evening, seeing Bud at his son's side, Lincoln laid his arm across Bud's shoulder and stroked Willie's hair. Turning to Bud, he said quietly, "You ought to go to bed, Bud." But Bud refused to leave, saying, "If I go, he will call for me." Returning later, Lincoln picked up Bud, who had fallen asleep, and carried him tenderly to bed. As news of the boy's critical condition spread through Washington, most of the celebratory illuminations were canceled. The Evening Star wrote that the President and Mrs. Lincoln have deep sympathy in this community in this hour of their affliction. Though work continued in the offices of the White House, staffers walked slowly down the corridors, as if they did not wish to make a noise. Lincoln's secretary, William Stoddard, recalled the question on everyone's lips, "Is there no hope?" "Not any, so the doctors say." At 5 p.m. on Thursday, February 20th, Willie died. Minutes later, Lincoln burst into Nicolay's office. "Well, Nicolay," he said, "my boy is gone. He is actually gone." He began to sob. According to Elizabeth Keckley, when Lincoln came back into the room after Willie's body had been washed and dressed, he buried his head in his hands and his tall frame was convulsed with emotion. Though Keckley had observed Lincoln more intimately than most, she did not dream that his rugged nature could be so moved. Mary Lincoln was inconsolable, Keckley recorded. The pale face of her dead boy threw her into convulsions. She had frequently said of her blue-eyed, handsome son that, if spared by Providence, he would be the hope and stay of her old age. She took to her bed with no way to sleep or ease her grief. Meanwhile, Tad was now critically ill. With Mary in no condition to care for him, Lincoln sought help. He sent his carriage to the Brownings, who came at once, and spent the night at Tad's bedside. He asked Gideon Wells's young wife, Mary Jane, to sit with the boy. Julia Bates, recovered from her stroke, also watched over him. Clearly, Tad required professional care around the clock. Lincoln turned to Dorothea Dix, the tireless crusader who had been appointed by the Secretary of War as superintendent of women nurses. She was a powerful woman with set ideas, among them the belief that women's corsets had a baneful effect on their health. She would routinely lecture young women on the subject. One girl refused to listen, insisting that she would rather be dead than so out of fashion. To this, Dix rejoined, "My dear, if you continue to lace as tightly as you do now, you will not long have the privilege of choice. You will be both dead and out of fashion." Asked to recommend a nurse, Dix chose Rebecca Pomeroy, a young widow who had worked on typhoid wards in two Washington hospitals. Introducing Nurse Pomeroy to Lincoln, Dix assured the president that she had more confidence in her than any other nurse, even those twice her age. Lincoln took Pomeroy's hand and smiled, saying, "Well, all I want to say is, let her turn right in." While Willie's body lay in the green room and Mary remained in bed under sedation, Nurse Pomeroy tended Tad. Whenever possible, the president brought his work into Tad's room and sat with his son, who was tossing with typhoid. Always curious and compassionate about other people's lives, Lincoln asked the new nurse about her family. She explained that she was a widow and had lost two children. Her one remaining child was in the army. Hearing her painful story, he began to cry, both for her and for his own stricken family. "This is the hardest trial of my life," he said. "Why is it? Oh, why is it?" Several times during the long nights, Tad would awaken and call for his father. The moment the president heard Taddy's voice, he was at his side. unmindful of the picture he presented in his dressing gown and slippers. On the Sunday after Willie's death, Lincoln drove with Browning to Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown to inspect the vault where his son's body would lie until his final burial in Springfield. The funeral service was scheduled for 2 p.m. in the East Room the following day. Though scores of people were invited, Mary asked Mrs. Taft to keep the boys home the day of the funeral. It makes me feel worse to see them. Nonetheless, without consulting his distraught wife, Lincoln sent for Bud to see Willie before he was put in the casket. He lay with his eyes closed, the essayist Nathaniel Parker Willis recalled, his brown hair parted as we had known it, pale in the slumber of death, but otherwise unchanged, for he was dressed as if for the evening. At noontime, the president, the first lady, and Robert entered the green room to bid farewell to Willie before the casket was closed. Commissioner French was told that the Lincolns wanted no spectator of their last sad moments in that house with their dead child, and that Mary was so overcome she could not attend the East Room service. Congress had adjourned so that members could attend the service. Many of those present had attended the ball just 19 days earlier. The Vice President, the Cabinet, the Diplomatic Corps, General McClellan and his staff. As the funeral guests filed in, a frightful storm arose. Heavy rain and high winds uprooted trees, destroyed a church, and tore the roofs off many houses. After the service was concluded, a long line of carriages made its way through the tempest to the cemetery chapel, where Willie was laid to rest temporarily inside the vault. Lincoln, who had so agonized whenever the stormy weather had pelted the grave of his first love, Anne Rutledge, perhaps found some solace that his son's body was now sheltered from the rain and howling wind. In the weeks that followed, Lincoln worried about Mary, who remained in her bed, unable to cope with daily life. Though Tad eventually recovered, Mary found it difficult to endure his company, which only intensified her sense of Willie's absence. Nor could she bear to see Bud and Holly Taft. She never invited them back to the White House, leaving Tad utterly isolated. Understanding the situation, the president tried to keep his son by his side, often carrying the boy to his own bed at night. Mary seemed to find some small comfort in her conversations with Rebecca Pomeroy and Mary Jane Wells. The latter, who spent many nights keeping vigil at Tad's bedside, had lost 5 children of her own and could relate to Mary's sorrow. In her talks with Mrs. Pomeroy, Mary tried to understand how the widow could bear to nurse the children of strangers after the devastation of her own family. Mary knew that she should surrender to God's will, but found she could not. Looking back on Willie's bout with scarlet fever 2 years earlier, she concluded that he was spared only to try us and wean us from a world whose chains were fastening around us. But when the blow came, she was still unprepared to face it. "Our home is very beautiful," she wrote a friend 3 months after Willie's death. "The world still smiles and pays homage. Yet the charm is dispelled. Everything appears a mockery. The idolized one is not with us." Indeed, the luxury and vanity in which she had indulged herself now seemed to taunt her. She plunged deeper into guilt and grief, speculating that God had struck Willie down as punishment for her overweening pride in her family's exalted status. "I had become so wrapped up in the world, so devoted to our own political advancement, that I thought of little else," she acknowledged. She knew it was a sin to think thus, but she believed that God must have forsaken her in taking away so lovely a child. Nor could she fully accept the comfort Mary Jane Wells found in the belief that her children awaited her in heaven. If only she had faith that Willie was far happier in an afterlife than he had been when on Earth. Mary suggested to Mary Jane she might accept his loss, although in later years she would come to trust that death is only a blessed transition to a place where there are no more partings and no more tears shed. Her faith at this juncture was not strong enough to provide solace. Crippled by her sadness, Mary was drawn to the relief offered by the spiritualist world. Through Elizabeth Keckley, she was introduced to a celebrated medium who helped her, said Mary, pierce the veil that separates us from the loved and lost. During several seances, some conducted at the White House, she believed she was able to see Willie. Spiritualism would reach epic proportions during the Civil War, fueled perhaps by the overwhelming casualties. Mediums could offer comfort to the bereaved, assuring them, "The spirits of the dead do not pass from this earth, but remain here amongst us, unseen." One contemporary commented that it seemed as if one heard of nothing but of spirits and of mediums. All tables and other furniture seemed to have become alive. Some mediums communicated by producing rapping or knocking sounds. Others made tables tip and sway. Still others channeled voices of the dead. Whatever method they used, one scholar of the movement observes, they offered tangible evidence that the most refractory barrier on earth, the barrier of death, could be transcended by the power of sympathy. Mary's occasional glimpses of Willie provided only temporary relief. His death had left her an altered woman, Keckley observed. The mere mention of Willie's name would excite her emotion, and any trifling memento that recalled him would move her to tears. She was unable to look at his picture. She sent all his toys and clothes away. She refused to enter the guest room in which he died, or the green room in which he was laid out. Outwardly, the president appeared to cope with Willie's death better than his wife. He had important work to engage him every hour of the day. He was surrounded by dozens of officials who needed him to discuss plans, make decisions, and communicate them. Yet despite his relentless duties, he suffered an excruciating sense of loss. On the Thursday after his son died, and for several Thursdays thereafter, he closed himself off in the green room and gave way to his terrible grief. "That blow overwhelmed me," he told a White House visitor. "It showed me my weakness as I had never felt it before." Like Mary, Lincoln longed for Willie's presence, a longing fulfilled not through mediums but in his active dream life. 3 months after Willie's death, while reading aloud a passage from Shakespeare's King John, in which Constance grieves over the death of her son, Lincoln paused. He turned to a nearby army officer and said, "Did you ever dream of some lost friend and feel that you were having a sweet communion with him, and yet have a consciousness that it was not a reality? That is the way I dream of my lost boy, Willie." While Mary could not tolerate to see physical reminders of Willie, Lincoln cherished mementos of his son. He placed a picture Willie had painted on his mantelpiece so he could show it to visitors and tell stories about his beloved child. One Sunday after church, he invited Browning to the library to show him a scrapbook he had just found, in which Willie kept dates of various battles and programs from important events. Maintaining vivid consciousness of his dead child was essential for a man who believed that the dead live on only in the minds of the living. 10 months later, when he wrote young Fanny McCullough shortly after her father's battlefield death, he closed with the consolation of remembrance. In time, he promised her, "The memory of your dear father, instead of an agony, will yet be a sad, sweet feeling in your heart, of a purer and holier sort than you have known before." Now, more than ever before, Lincoln was able to identify in a profound and personal way with the sorrows of families who had lost their loved ones in the war. Chapter 16. He was simply outgeneraled. 2 days after Willie's death, General McClellan sent a private note expressing his heartfelt sympathy for the sad calamity that had overtaken the Lincoln family. "You have been a kind, true friend to me," the general told the president. "Your confidence has upheld me when I should otherwise have felt weak." Then, referring to the capture of Forts Henry and Donelson in the West as an auspicious commencement of his own forward campaign in the East, he beseeched Lincoln not to allow military affairs to give him one moment's trouble, for nothing shall be left undone in pursuit of victory. McClellan's assurances of forward movement provided Lincoln little comfort. The general had made similar promises for many months, while the great army of the Potomac sat idle. Criticism of the general, previously confined to newspapers, found a powerful voice in the newly created Congressional Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War. Dominated by radicals from both houses, including Ben Wade, Michigan's Zachariah Chandler, and Indiana's George Julian, the committee detested McClellan, both for his failure to prosecute the war vigorously and for his conservative views on slavery. From late December to mid-January, McClellan had remained in bed with typhoid. Suspicious that the general was using his illness as a cover for his continuing inaction, the committee held a contentious meeting with Lincoln and his cabinet. During the session, Congressman Julian recorded, it became disturbingly clear that neither the president nor his advisers seemed to have any definite information of General McClellan's plans. More astonishing, according to Julian, Lincoln himself did not think he had any right to know, but that as he was not a military man, it was his duty to defer to General McClellan. Bates strenuously objected to Lincoln's deferential stance, urging him repeatedly to organize a staff of his own and assume to be, in fact, what he is in law, the commander-in-chief, with a duty to command the commanders. This opinion, voiced by the conservative, trustworthy Bates, struck Lincoln forcefully. He borrowed General Halleck's book on military strategy from the Library of Congress, and told Browning a few days later that he was thinking of taking the field himself. Though his statement may not have reflected a literal intention, Lincoln had clearly resolved that he must energize the army at once. "The bottom is out of the tub," he confided in General Meigs, repeating a favorite phrase. The nearly bankrupt treasury could no longer sustain the enormous expense of providing food, clothing, and shelter for hundreds of thousands of immobile soldiers. Without some forward progress, Chase told the president, he would get no additional funds from a discontented public. Meigs suggested that Lincoln convene a war council with his other generals to formulate a decisive course of action. Receiving news of this, McClellan suddenly recovered sufficiently to attend the meeting on the following day. Still reluctant to expose his plans, McClellan told Meigs that the president can't keep a secret. He will tell them to Tad. Finally, Lincoln lost his vaunted patience. On January 27, 1862, he issued his famous General War Order No. 1, setting February 22nd as the day for a general movement of the land and naval forces of the United States against the insurgent forces. Lincoln correctly believed that, given the North's superior numbers, they should attack several rebel positions at the same time. The order prompted McClellan to submit his plans for a roundabout movement that developed into the Peninsula Campaign. The plan called for the troops to move by ship down the Potomac River to the Chesapeake Bay, with a turn into Urbana on the south shore of the Rappahannock River. From there, McClellan planned to march southwest to Richmond. Lincoln, backed by Stanton and several generals, including McDowell, proposed a different strategy. Troops would march overland through nearby Manassas, pushing the rebel army farther and farther back toward Richmond, destroying him by superior force. This straightforward approach would shield Washington, keeping the Union Army between the capital and the Confederates. Under McClellan's circuitous plan, it was feared that the Confederates might willingly sacrifice Richmond to capture Washington. If the South occupied the seat of the Union, foreign recognition of the Confederacy would undoubtedly follow. In the end, Lincoln reluctantly acquiesced to the Peninsula plan, but not before imposing a written order requiring that a sufficient force be left in and about Washington to keep the capital safe from attack. February 22nd, the date designated for the advance, arrived and went, with Lincoln deeply preoccupied by Willie's death and Tad's grievous illness. A disheartened Stanton noted that there was no more sign of movement on the Potomac than there had been for 3 months before. When he first took his cabinet position, Stanton later explained, he was, and for months had been, the sincere and devoted friend of General McClellan. But he had quickly grown disenchanted. After less than 2 weeks as Secretary of War, he told a friend that, while men are striving nobly in the West, the champagne and oysters on the Potomac must be stopped. Stanton's remark alluded to the sumptuous dinners McClellan hosted each evening for nearly 24 guests, many of whom were prominent figures in Washington's southern-leaning society. Stanton was further disgruntled when McClellan kept him waiting on a number of occasions. Unlike Lincoln, the proud war secretary did not ignore the arrogance of the general-in-chief. After one particularly galling experience, when he had been forced to wait for an hour after stopping by McClellan's headquarters on his way to the War Department, Stanton angrily announced, "That will be the last time General McClellan will give either myself or the President the waiting snub." A few weeks later, Stanton delivered orders to transfer the telegraph office from McClellan's headquarters to a room adjoining his office in the War Department. Dispatches from the miraculous new system that connected Washington with army officials, camps, and forts throughout the entire North would no longer be funneled through McClellan. McClellan was furious, considering the transfer his humiliation. He had indeed lost significant influence, for the adjacent telegraph office not only allowed Stanton to exercise control over all military communications, but ensured that Lincoln would now spend many daily hours with his war secretary rather than his general-in-chief. Still, McClellan had powerful allies in the cabinet, including the influential Montgomery Blair. The Democratic press largely credited the young Napoleon for the victories at Forts Henry and Donelson, as if Grant and the troops were merely puppets with McClellan pulling the strings from Washington. Stanton noted satirically that the image portrayed in the papers of a heroic McClellan seated at the telegraph office, organizing victory, and by sublime military combinations capturing Fort Donelson 6 hours after Grant and Smith had taken it, was a picture worthy of Punch. As it turned out, the victories in the West increased the pressure on McClellan to act. At last, on the weekend of March 8th, the massive Army of the Potomac prepared to break camp. Anticipating the move, the Confederates began to pull their batteries back from Manassas to the banks of the Rappahannock. Hearing reports of the fallback, McClellan led his armies on a short foray to catch the remaining troops. But once there, he found to his great embarrassment that the entire Confederate force had already departed, with their tents, supplies, and weapons. Still more humiliating, the supposedly impregnable fortifications that had deterred him for months turned out to be simply wooden logs painted black to resemble cannons. Had McClellan attacked any time in the previous months, he would have had superiority in numbers and weapons. The Quaker gun affair, as the stage prop guns were called, provoked the wrath of radicals. "We shall be the scorn of the world," Senator Fessenden wrote his wife. "It is no longer doubtful that General McClellan is utterly unfit for his position, and yet the President will keep him in command." The embarrassing situation should have been expected, Fessenden lamented, for we went in for a rail splitter, and we have got one. Echoing Fessenden's dismay, the Committee on the Conduct of the War demanded McClellan's resignation. When Lincoln asked who they proposed to replace McClellan, one of the committee members growled, "Anybody." Lincoln's reply was swift. "Anybody will do for you, but not for me. I must have somebody." Lincoln was convinced that something had to be done. On March 11th, he issued a war order that relieved McClellan from his post as general-in-chief, but left him in charge of the Army of the Potomac. Lincoln gave Halleck command of the Department of the Mississippi, and, in a move that delighted the radicals, reinstated Fremont to take charge of a newly created Mountain Department. The post of general-in-chief was not filled, leaving Lincoln and Stanton to determine overall strategy. McClellan later recalled that he learned through the public newspapers that he was displaced, claiming that no one in authority had ever expressed to him the slightest disapprobation. He was infuriated. Lincoln sent Ohio's Governor Dennison to his camp to assure him that this was not a demotion. The president, Dennison explained, simply wanted General McClellan to focus his full energies on the all-important Army of the Potomac, whose actions would most likely determine the result of the war. Lincoln anticipated that his Postmaster General, Monty Blair, would stridently oppose McClellan's removal from high command. The conservative Blair family were staunch McClellan supporters, a loyalty that would continue in the months ahead. Referring to his radical detractors, Francis Blair Sr. warned the general not to let the carpet knights in Congress, who would sacrifice anyone's blood but their own, hurry or worry him into doing anything. Meanwhile, Washington gossip spread that Monty Blair was openly berating his fellow cabinet colleague Stanton for his failure to support McClellan. While conservatives vilified Stanton, radicals upbraided the Blairs as preservers of slavery for defending the inert McClellan at Stanton's expense. Already troubled by McClellan's loss of central control, the powerful Blair family was enraged by Lincoln's decision to reinstall Fremont in a position of command. Monty Blair privately considered Fremont's appointment unpalatable and warned his father that it would be mortifying to Frank, who had been humiliated by his arrest and imprisonment by Fremont. Lizzie Blair told her husband it was urged by Chase and Stanton, who has his revenges too, and that her brother Frank felt it intensely. Only 4 days earlier, with the backing of Democrats and conservative Republicans, Frank Blair had delivered a blistering attack against Fremont on the floor of the House. Fremont had come to Washington at the request of the Committee on the Conduct of the War. For weeks, radicals on the committee had pressured Lincoln to give the Emancipator, as they called Fremont, a second chance. Congressman Schuyler Colfax eloquently defended their position when he rose to the floor immediately after Frank Blair to deliver a scorching point-by-point repudiation of Blair's address. The bitter public quarrel between the Blairs and Fremont must have given Lincoln pause as he considered reinstating Fremont. Though the appointment would thrill the radicals, it might cost him the allegiance of the Blairs, and thereby destroy the delicate balance he had worked to foster between the conservatives and the radicals. As it happened, a magnanimous gesture by Lincoln, just 6 days before Fremont's appointment, played an important role in resolving the complex situation. On March 5th, Monty Blair had come to the White House in great distress. The New York Tribune had just published a private letter that he had written to Fremont the previous summer, before the family feud had begun. In the letter, furnished by Fremont to the press in an attempt to embarrass Blair, The Postmaster General had complained that Lincoln's past affiliations had brought him naturally not only to incline to the feeble policy of Whigs, but to give his confidence to such advisers. It costs me a great deal of labor to get anything done because of the inclination of mind on the part of the President. Elizabeth Blair described her brother's meeting with Lincoln in a note to her husband. Brother just took the letter up to the P and asked him to read it. Lincoln refused, saying he did not intend to read it, as it was published for that very purpose. Monty acknowledged it was a foolish letter that he deeply regretted. It is due to you, he told the President, to make some amends by resigning my place. I leave the whole thing to you and will do exactly as you wish. The President had no desire to exact retribution or remove Blair. Forget it, he said, and never mention or think of it again. A grateful Monty Blair immediately came to Lincoln's defense regarding the Fremont appointment. Although he had not been consulted about the decision and realized his family would consider it a blatant affront to Frank, he told his father that he understood Lincoln's need to arrest the spread of factions in the country and prevent divisions at this time. And for that reason, he thought very well of it. The conservative New York Times agreed, approving Fremont's appointment as a necessary concession to this craving for unity and the value of united councils. In his conduct of the war, the Times observed, Lincoln believed tenaciously in the necessity of perfect unity of popular opinion and action in the North. More than any other cabinet member, Seward appreciated Lincoln's peerless skill in balancing factions, both within his administration and in the country at large. While radicals considered Seward a conservative influence on the President, in truth, he and the President were engaged in the same task of finding a middle position between the two extremes. The radical Republicans, who believed that freeing the slaves should be the primary goal of the war, and the conservative Democrats, who resisted any change in the status of the slaves and fought solely for the restoration of the Union. Somebody must be in a position to mollify and moderate, Seward told Weed. That is the task of the P and the S of S. In another letter to his old friend, Seward expressed great confidence in Lincoln. The President is wise and practical, he wrote. His trust in Lincoln was complete, inspiring faith in the eventual success of the Union cause. From the outside, however, Seward was viewed by the radicals as a malevolent influence on Lincoln. Count Gorofsky despaired at Seward's supposed ties with McClellan, Blair, and their allies in the conservative press. "Oh, Mr. Seward, Mr. Seward," he queried, "why is your name to be recorded among the most ardent supporters of McClellan's strategy?" In fact, already by the middle of March, Seward had lost his early faith in McClellan and wondered why Lincoln did not strip him of command. In a private conversation with a friend, Seward scorned McClellan's inflated estimates of enemy strength, suggesting that the Union troops from New York State alone probably outnumbered all the Confederate forces in Northern Virginia. Nonetheless, he refrained from airing his doubts in public. In the wake of the Quaker Gun affair, Lincoln's confidence in McClellan had also eroded. While acknowledging that the general was a great engineer, Lincoln noted drolly that he seems to have a special talent for developing a stationary engine. The more he studied the general, he confided to Browning, the more he realized that when the hour for action approached, he became nervous and oppressed with the responsibility and hesitated to meet the crisis. For this reason, Lincoln had given him peremptory orders to move. Finally, 24 hours before Lincoln's deadline, McClellan's massive army of nearly a quarter of a million men left the base camps around Washington and headed toward the Potomac, where more than 400 ships had gathered to carry them to Fort Monroe in Hampton Roads, Virginia. Parading to the refrains of regimental bands, with rifles on their shoulders and new equipment on their backs, the high-spirited, well-disciplined troops presented a sight, one diarist noted, such as the eye of man has seldom seen. Before the army set sail, McClellan delivered an emotional address. "I will bring you now face to face with the rebels," he told his beloved troops. "Ever bear in mind that my fate is linked with yours. I am to watch over you as a parent over his children, and you know that your general loves you from the depths of his heart." When most of the force had reached Fort Monroe, Stanton later recalled, "Information was given to me by various persons that there was great reason to fear that no adequate force had been left to defend the capital, despite Lincoln's explicit order that Washington should, by the judgment of all the commanders of army corps, be left entirely secure." Stanton referred the matter to Lorenzo Thomas, the adjutant general, who, after surveying the circumstance, concluded that the president's order had most definitely not been obeyed. McClellan had left behind less than 20,000 raw recruits, with not a single organized brigade, a force utterly incapable of defending Washington from sudden attack. Enraged, Stanton carried the damning report to the president at midnight. Lincoln promptly withdrew General McDowell's First Corps from McClellan's command so that Washington would be protected. That withdrawal, Stanton later recalled, provoked McClellan's wrath and the wrath of his friends. With immense forces still at his disposal, McClellan advanced from Fort Monroe to the outskirts of Yorktown, roughly 50 miles from Richmond, once again mistakenly insisting that the rebel force outnumbered his. McClellan kept his army in a state of perpetual preparation. His engineers spent precious weeks constructing earthworks so his big guns could quash rebel defenses before the infantry assault. On April 6th, Lincoln telegraphed McClellan, "You now have over 100,000 troops. I think you better break the enemy's line from Yorktown to Warwick River at once. They will probably use time as advantageously as you can." The following day, McClellan scorned the president's admonition, informing his wife that if Lincoln wanted the enemy line broken, he had better come and do it himself. Still, McClellan persisted in his baffling inaction. He notified Stanton that the enemy batteries are stronger than anticipated. Stanton was livid. "You were sent on purpose to take strong batteries," he reminded McClellan. Later that day, Lincoln telegraphed the general, warning that further delay would only allow the enemy to summon reinforcements from other theaters. "It is indispensable to you that you strike a blow," Lincoln advised his commander on April 9th. "The country will not fail to note, is now noting, that the present hesitation to move upon an entrenched enemy is but the story of Manassas repeated. I beg to assure you that I have never written you or spoken to you in greater kindness of feeling than now. But you must act." 2 more weeks passed without any sign of movement. "Do not misunderstand the apparent inaction here," McClellan wired Lincoln. "Not a day, not an hour has been lost. Works have been constructed that may almost be called gigantic. Roads built through swamps and difficult ravines. Material brought up. Batteries built." In another letter to his wife, he rationalized his continuing delay with the dubious contention that the more troops the enemy gathered in Yorktown, the more decisive the results will be. A few days later, McClellan formulated yet another justification for postponement, arguing that he had been compelled to change plans and become cautious without McDowell's First Corps that had been taken from him to protect Washington. This left him unexpectedly weakened, and with a powerful enemy strongly entrenched in my front. Therefore, he was not answerable for the delay of victory. As it happened, Confederate General Joe Johnston, after keeping McClellan at bay for a month with substantially inferior numbers, had decided in early May to withdraw 12 miles up the peninsula toward Richmond. Hearing that a fallback was underway, McClellan finally moved on Yorktown to discover that in a repeat of his experience at Manassas, the rebels were gone. Though he tried to claim the rebel retreat as a great bloodless victory, the public was unconvinced, and the question remained, why had he kept idle for a month? Had he moved on Yorktown with his greater numbers, he could have done serious damage to the rebel army. In the meantime, just as Lincoln had forewarned, the long delay had allowed the rebels to bring additional forces from various theaters into the peninsula, where, under General Johnston's command, they prepared for a counteroffensive. Anxiety surrounding the impending battle did little to curtail the spring social season in Washington. If anything, the pace of social life accelerated, as Washingtonians sought relaxation and entertainment in the traditional round of calls, receptions, soirees, musicales, and dinners. Once the air turned soft and balmy, the National Republican reported, the public squares came alive with crowds of visitors who either tread its graveled walks or seat themselves beneath the trees, listening to the songs of birds and the joyful shouts of children rolling their hoops over the ground. Mary remained in mourning for Willie, however, and the traditional spring receptions in the White House were canceled, along with the Marine Band concerts on the lawn. In the social vacuum, Kate Chase took command of the Washington social scene, making her a powerful asset to her father. Her intermittent romance with the Rhode Island-based Sprague did not diminish her signal commitment to her father, whose household she managed with matchless style. Her social supremacy derived in part from her striking appearance, enhanced by the simple but elegant wardrobe assembled during her many trips to New York in pursuit of furnishings for her father's mansion. She was more of a professional beauty than had at that time ever been seen in America, noted Mary Adams French, the wife of the famed sculptor Daniel Chester French, with a beauty and a regal carriage which we called queenly, but which no real queen ever has. In an era when the universal art of being slim had not been discovered, Mrs. French continued, the tall and slim Kate seemed otherworldly. She had an unusually long white neck and a slow and deliberate way of turning it when she glanced around her. Wherever she appeared, people dropped back in order to watch her. Fanny Villard, wife of the journalist Henry Villard, was one of many who looked with awe on Kate. I, a simple young homebody from New England, never before had seen so beautiful and brilliant a creature as Kate Chase, and it seemed to me then that nothing could blight her perfection. And yet, Kate's grace and beauty accounted for only a small part of her social success. Her emergence as the foremost lady of Washington society resulted as much from hard work and meticulous planning as from her natural assets. She met each morning with her household servants, giving detailed instructions for the day's activities. Continuing the ritual she had established in Columbus, she and her father hosted regular breakfast parties for out-of-town guests. Her correspondence reveals the elaborate preparations these affairs entailed. A letter to her father's friend, the Philadelphia banker Jay Cook, requests that he stop at Van Zandt's, where you find the best fruit, and have a basket full of the best and prettiest grapes, pears, oranges, apples, etc., sent me by Adams Express, so that they may arrive here without fail early Tuesday morning. She regretted the imposition, but she could not think of anyone who would do it quite so well. and was especially anxious to make this an attractive and agreeable occasion. In addition to these early morning breakfasts, Kate presided over weekly receptions known as cabinet calling days. Every Monday, a contemporary Washingtonian wrote, the wives of the cabinet officers receive their friends. Also, Mrs. McClellan is at home on this same day. Through the late morning and early afternoon, regardless of rain, mud, or snow, the ladies of Washington made the rounds, visiting in turn each cabinet member's home. First to Mrs. Seward's, columnist Kara Kaysen reported, where Anna Seward officiated in the absence of Francis. A black doorman delivered their card to yet another servant, who placed it in the silver card receiver, at the same moment ushering us in, names clearly pronounced, to the presence of Mrs. Seward. Greetings were exchanged and refreshments served before proceeding to the next reception at Mrs. Caleb Smith's. There they found an elegantly set table, salads, and all good things. After visiting Mrs. Wells, who always entertained in her friendly manner, the ladies would take a glass of wine at Mrs. Blair's, admire the queenly dignity of Miss Chase, enjoy a delightful talk with the kindly family of Mrs. Bates, and then drive on to pay our respects to Mrs. McClellan and Mrs. Stanton. While Kate hosted the weekly cabinet receptions with elegance and grace, she devoted her greatest efforts to the celebrated candlelight dinners she held each Wednesday evening. With exacting care, she drew up the guest lists, prepared the menus, and arranged seating. With her father occupying the head of the table, she would help maintain lively, entertaining conversation from her place at the other end. After dinner, a band would play, and dancing would begin. Diplomats and statesmen felt it an honor to be her guests, and men of letters found that they needed their keenest wits to be her match in conversation, one reporter noted. Her drawing room was a salon, and it has been paralleled only in the anti-revolutionary days of the French monarchy, when women ruled the empire of the Bourbons. Over time, the Chase home increasingly became a forum for critics of the Lincoln administration. In the relaxed atmosphere of Kate's private dinner parties, William Fessenden could freely condemn Lincoln's reluctance to confront the emancipation question. The members of the Committee on the Conduct of the War could censure General McClellan more harshly than public statement would safely allow. Over coffee and dessert in the parlor, the women could spread disdainful gossip about Mary Lincoln. Kate clearly understood the role that parlor politics could play in cementing alliances and consolidating power in furtherance of her father's irrepressible political ambitions. She was determined to create nothing less than a rival court to the White House that could help catapult Chase to the presidency. In the spring of 1862, she reigned supreme. The most compelling conversations in the Chase drawing room that balmy spring swirled around the proclamation of General David Hunter, an old friend of Lincoln's who commanded the Department of the South, which encompassed South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. In early May, acting without prior approval from the White House, Hunter had issued an official order declaring forever free all slaves in the three states under his jurisdiction. Chase's circle was exultant, for Hunter's proclamation went beyond even General Fremont's attempt of the previous August. "It seems to me of the highest importance," Chase wrote to Lincoln, "that this order not be revoked. It will be cordially approved, I am sure, by more than 9/10 of the people on whom you must rely for support of your administration." Lincoln's reply to Chase was swift and blunt. "No commanding general shall do such a thing upon my responsibility without consulting me." By repudiating Hunter's proclamation, Lincoln understood that he would give dissatisfaction, if not offense, to many whose support the country cannot afford to lose. He firmly believed, however, that any such proclamation must come from the commander-in-chief, not from a general in the field. "General Hunter is an honest man," Lincoln told a delegation after officially revoking Hunter's order. "He was, and I hope still is, my friend. He expected more good and less harm from the measure than I could believe would follow." While Seward and Stanton supported Lincoln's decision, Chase publicly disagreed. In conversations with Sumner and others, he openly denounced Lincoln's action, fanning talk among the more advanced members of the Republican Party about Lincoln's pusillanimity. Chase's defiance earned him plaudits from the New York Tribune. "All the more warmly appreciated," Chase told Horace Greeley, given the influential editor's earlier unfavorable judgments of his public career. Chase maintained to Greeley that he had not been so sorely tried by anything here, though I have seen a great deal in the shape of irregularity, assumptions beyond law, extravagance, and deference to generals and reactionists which I could not approve, as by the nullifying of Hunter's proclamation. Rumors began to surface that the controversy would cause an open rupture in the cabinet and precipitate Chase's departure. Still, so long as Lincoln believed Chase was the right man for the Treasury, he had no intention of requesting his resignation. As for Chase, so long as he could garner radical support by publicly opposing Lincoln on this critical issue, he would productively remain in the cabinet until the time was right to make a break. In the first week of May, Lincoln resolved to end months of frustration with McClellan by personally visiting Fort Monroe. Stanton had suggested that a presidential journey to the tip of the peninsula might finally spur McClellan to act. On the evening of Monday, May 5th, the president arrived at the Navy Yard and boarded the Miami, a 5-gun Treasury cutter, accompanied by Stanton, Chase, and General Egbert Vielleicht. The cabin, Vielleicht recalled, was neat and cozy, a center table, buffet, and washstand, with 4 berths, 2 on each side, and some comfortable chairs, constituted its chief appointments. Since the Miami was a Treasury ship, Chase seemed to feel that we were his guests, General Vielleicht observed. The Treasury Secretary even brought his own butler to serve meals and treated us as if we were in his own house. Both Chase and Stanton began the 27-hour journey anxious about all the work they had left behind. As the hours passed by, however, they warmed to Lincoln's high-spirited discourse and began to relax. General Vielleicht marveled how Lincoln was always the center of the circle gathered on the quarter-deck, keeping everyone engrossed for hours as he recited passages from Shakespeare, page after page of Browning and whole cantos of Byron. Talking much of the day, he interspersed stories and anecdotes from his inexhaustible stock. Many, as usual, were directly applicable to a point made in conversation, but some were simply jokes that set Lincoln laughing louder than all the combined listeners. One of his favorite anecdotes told of a schoolboy called up by the teacher to be disciplined. "Hold out your hand." A paw of the most surprising description was extended, more remarkable for its filthiness than anything else. The schoolmaster was so stunned that he said, "Now, if there were such another dirty thing in the room, I would let you off." "There it is," quoth the unmoved culprit, drawing the other hand from behind his back. While the presidential party lounged on the deck, Lincoln playfully demonstrated that in muscular power he was 1 in 1,000, possessing the strength of a giant. He picked up an axe and held it at arm's length at the extremity of the handle with his thumb and forefinger, continuing to hold it there for a number of minutes. The most powerful sailors on board tried in vain to imitate him. After the Tuesday luncheon table was cleared, the president and his advisers pored over maps and analyzed the army positions in and around Virginia. Union forces at Fort Monroe occupied the northern shore of Hampton Roads, which connected the Chesapeake to Three Rivers. Confederate forces on the southern shore still held Norfolk and the Navy Yard. 2 months earlier, the rebels had used this strategic foothold to great advantage by sending the powerful 9-gun Merrimack, a scuttled Union ship that they had raised and covered with iron plates, into a series of devastating engagements. In the space of 5 hours, the ironclad had managed to sink, capture, and incapacitate 3 ships and 2 Union frigates. The news had terrified government officials, who feared that the invincible Merrimack might sail up the Potomac to attack Washington, or even continue on to New York. "It is a disgrace to the country that the rebels, without resources, have built a vessel with which we cannot cope," General Meigs had grumbled. An emergency cabinet meeting was convened, during which Stanton unfairly faulted Wells for the disaster. His attack was so personal, according to Wells's biographer, that the Navy Secretary found it very difficult for a time even to be civil in Stanton's presence. In fact, the Navy had been more than adequately prepared to deal with the Merrimack. The very next day, the Monitor, a strange ironclad vessel resembling a cheesebox on a raft, engaged the Merrimack in battle. Though the little Monitor seemed a pygmy to a giant, it proved far more maneuverable. Commanded by Lieutenant John L. Worden, who directed 2 large guns from a revolving turret, the Monitor fought the Merrimack to a draw and sent the Confederate vessel back to the harbor. When Stanton learned that Worden might lose one eye as a result of the struggle, he said, "Then we will fill the other with diamonds." To Herman Melville, as to many others, the Battle of the 2 Ironclads marked the beginning of a new epoch in warfare. "The ringing of those plates on plates still ringeth round the world," he wrote. "War yet shall be, but warriors are now but operatives." As the president and his advisers huddled over maps of Fort Monroe, Norfolk, and the surrounding area, they could not understand why McClellan had not ordered an attack on Norfolk immediately after his occupation of Yorktown. The Confederate retreat up the peninsula had left the city and the Navy Yard vulnerable. Though the Monitor had held its own against the Merrimack, there was no assurance that this feat would be repeated. If Norfolk were captured, perhaps the Merrimack could be captured as well. With McClellan and his troops about 20 miles away, Lincoln and his little group came to a decision of their own. If General John E. Wool, commander of Fort Monroe, had sufficient forces at his disposal, an immediate attack should be made on Norfolk. Disconcerted by the prospect, the 78-year-old General Wool insisted on consulting Commodore Louis Goldsborough, since the Navy's warships would have to immobilize the Confederate batteries before any troops could be safely landed. In the black of night, the Miami could not easily pull aside the Minnesota, Goldsborough's flagship. So Lincoln's party climbed into a tugboat and approached the port side of the Minnesota. The steps leading up to the deck were very narrow, Chase wrote, with the guiding ropes on either hand hardly visible in the darkness. "It seemed to me very high and a little fearsome. But etiquette required the president to go first, and he went. Etiquette required the Secretary of the Treasury to follow." Stanton, climbing immediately behind Chase, must have overcome even greater trepidation, for an accident when he was younger had left one leg permanently damaged, and he suffered besides from frequent attacks of vertigo. Fortunately, they all made it aboard without mishap. Though Lincoln was probably unfamiliar with Commodore Goldsborough, Chase had known him for several decades. The distinguished naval officer had won the hand of William Wirt's daughter, Elizabeth, at a time when Chase had not been deemed an appropriate suitor. Goldsboro approved the idea of attack, in theory, but feared that so long as the Merrimack was still a factor, it was too risky to carry troops across the water. Lincoln disagreed, and orders were given to begin shelling the Confederate batteries. Before long, a smoke curled up over the woods, Chase recalled, and each man almost said to the other, "There comes the Merrimack," and sure enough it was the Merrimack. However, upon spying the Monitor, accompanied by a second powerful ship, the great rebel terror paused, then turned back. The next day, Lincoln, Chase, and Stanton each personally surveyed the shoreline to determine the best landing place for the troops. Under a full moon, Lincoln went ashore in a rowboat. He walked on enemy soil and then returned to the Miami. Once the best spot was chosen, Chase pushed for an immediate attack, worried that McClellan might appear and delay the attack. The next night, the convoys headed for shore. They discovered that the rebels had decided to evacuate Norfolk and scuttle the Merrimack to keep it out of Union hands soon after the shelling began. As the Union troops moved uncontested into the city, Chase, accompanying Generals Wool and Vielley, heard the soldiers shouting cheer after cheer. In the city center, they were met by a delegation of civilian authorities who formally surrendered Norfolk to General Vielley. The general remained in City Hall as military governor of the region. It was after midnight when Chase and General Wool finally returned to the Miami. Lincoln and Stanton, after waiting nervously all evening for their return, had just retired to their rooms. "The night was very warm," Lincoln recalled, "the moon shining brightly. And, too restless to sleep, I threw off my clothes and sat for some time by the table, reading." Hearing a knock at Stanton's door, which was directly below his own, he guessed that the missing men had come back at last. Minutes later, Chase and General Wool came to Lincoln's room. Eschewing ceremony, Wool happily announced, "Norfolk is ours!" Stanton, who had burst in just out of bed, clad in a long nightgown, was so jubilant over the news that he rushed at the general, whom he hugged most affectionately, fairly lifting him from the floor in his delight. Lincoln recognized that the scene must have been a comical one, with Stanton clad in a nightgown that nearly swept the floor, and he himself having just undressed. Nevertheless, they were all too greatly excited to take much note of mere appearances. Beside the capture of Norfolk, the destruction of the fearsome Merrimack would open the supply lines from Washington to the peninsula. When the triumphant trio returned to Washington, reporters noted that Stanton was conveyed home seriously ill. Physicians feared at first that he was suffering from one of the bouts of vertigo that immobilized him for days at a time. He soon recovered, however, and enjoyed the sweetness of victory in what the Civil War historian Shelby Foote has called one of the strangest small-scale campaigns in American military history. Unusually buoyant, Chase expressed greater admiration for the president than he ever had before or ever would again. "So has ended a brilliant week's campaign of the president," Chase wrote, "for I think it quite certain that if he had not come down, Norfolk would still have been in possession of the enemy, and the Merrimack as grim and defiant and as much a terror as ever. The whole coast is now virtually ours." Not surprisingly, McClellan refused to credit the president for the return of Norfolk to the Union. "Norfolk is in our possession," he flatly declared to his wife, "the result of my movements." The day after Lincoln's triumphant return, Navy Secretary Wells invited Seward, Bates, and their families to join him and his wife for a 6-day cruise along the coast of Virginia. now cleared of rebel forces and the menacing Merrimack. "We had 2 pilots and 13 sailors, Fred Seward informed his mother, "Wormley and his cook and waiters, 2 howitzers, and 2 dozen muskets, coal and provisions for a week, field glasses and maps." The armed Navy steamer took them to Norfolk and the Gosport Navy Yard, where they viewed the ruins of the Merrimack. They proceeded up York River to McClellan's new headquarters at West Point, 30 miles from Richmond. The cabinet colleagues enjoyed an easy camaraderie as the steamer moved from one river to the next. They consumed hearty meals, sang patriotic songs to the music of a Navy band, and joked with one another. When Seward discovered that rats had eaten a tie and socks belonging to Bates, he composed a humorous poem, complete with sketches, to commemorate the occasion. By day they went ashore and wandered through the seaboard towns now in possession of the Union armies. "Virginia is sad to look upon," Seward wrote to his wife. "Not merely the rebellion, but society itself is falling into ruin. Slaves are deserting the homes entrusted to them by their masters, who have gone into the Southern armies or are fleeing before ours. There is universal stagnation, and sullenness prevails everywhere." Like Lincoln, Seward was always sensitive to the devastation of war. Despite his satisfaction at the recent Union successes that had subdued this part of Virginia, he was disquieted by the bleakness he encountered. "We saw war, not in its holiday garb," he told Fanny, "but in its stern and fearful aspect. We saw the desolation that follows and the terror that precedes its march." The steamer reached McClellan's camp at about 3 p.m. on May 13th. Approaching the shore, Fred Seward was amazed to find that a clearing in the woods had been suddenly transformed into a great city of 100,000 people by the advent of McClellan's army and its supporting fleet. McClellan escorted the party ashore, where they reviewed thousands of his troops and discussed the general's plans. Though McClellan considered such visits a nuisance, he convinced his official guests that, if properly reinforced, he would soon prevail in a decisive fight this side of Richmond, which would be one of the great historic battles of the world. McClellan's high-spirited, well-disciplined troops and the gigantic size of the operation were impressive to all. At night, Fred Seward observed, the long lines of lights on the shore, the shipping and bustle in the river, made it almost impossible to believe we were not in the harbor of Philadelphia or New York. After the meeting with McClellan, Seward advised Lincoln by telegraph that McDowell's forces should be sent to the York River to reinforce McClellan as soon as possible. Lincoln and Stanton agreed. McDowell was ordered to move his entire force from the vicinity of Washington to the peninsula. For weeks, McClellan's Democratic supporters had publicly criticized the President and Secretary of War for retaining McDowell's force out of irrational fear for Washington. Yet now that McClellan stood to have his demands met, he told Lincoln that he wouldn't receive McDowell's men unless it was clear that he would have absolute authority over them. McClellan considered McDowell a radical on the issue of slavery, and despised him personally, calling him an animal in a letter to his wife. Lincoln assured McClellan by telegraph that he was in command. The day after Lincoln ordered McDowell to prepare for the move south, he made an impromptu visit, accompanied by Stanton and Dahlgren, to McDowell's headquarters at Fredericksburg. The trip was arranged so suddenly that Captain Dahlgren had no chance to bring food or beds aboard the steamboat that was to carry them to Aquia Landing. Despite the makeshift accommodations, Lincoln relaxed at once, reading aloud from the works of a contemporary poet, Fitzgreen Halleck, then considered the American Byron. Lincoln chose that night to read Marco Botsaris, a lengthy poem celebrating the death of a Greek hero in the war against Turkey. Lincoln was drawn to the poet's vision of a lasting greatness, of deeds that would resound throughout history. Because of such achievements in life, both Greece, in which there is no prouder grave, and the mother who gave thee birth, can speak of thy doom without a sigh. For thou art freedom's now and fame's, one of the few, the immortal names, that were not born to die. When Lincoln and his party reached Acquia Creek shortly after dawn, they were driven to McDowell's camp in what Dahlgren described as a common baggage car with camp stools for the party. McDowell was eager to show the little group his army's accomplishments in having rebuilt bridges and repaired telegraph lines, creating a direct link between Washington and Fredericksburg. The general was particularly proud of a new trestle bridge that spanned a creek and deep ravine at a height of 100 feet. Though there was nothing but a single plank for us to walk on, Dahlgren recalled, Lincoln impulsively said, "Let us walk over." So the president, followed by McDowell, and then poor Stanton, understandably fearful of heights, and finally Dahlgren, began the hazardous journey. About halfway, Dahlgren wrote, the secretary said he was dizzy and feared he would fall. So he stopped, unable to proceed. I managed to step by him and took his hand, thus leading him over, when in fact my own head was somewhat confused by the giddy height. After breakfast, the president and McDowell mounted horses and spent the day inspecting the troops. Enduring a hot sun without the protection of a hat, Lincoln reviewed one division after another, all in fine order, the men cheering tremendously. After a simple meal, the presidential party returned to Acquia Creek, departing for Washington sometime after 10 p.m. Lincoln was in good spirits, according to Dahlgren. Once again he read poetry aloud, and they all retired to their makeshift beds. Before falling asleep, Stanton confided to Dahlgren that he did not think much of McDowell. Troublesome news reached Washington the following day that General Stonewall Jackson had been sent to attack Union forces in the Shenandoah Valley, hoping to prevent McDowell from moving south. The goal was realized. After Jackson attacked Front Royal, forcing General Banks to hastily retreat north to Winchester, the president telegraphed McClellan, "I have been compelled to suspend General McDowell's movement to join you." He followed up with a telegram explaining that with Jackson chasing Banks farther and farther north, Washington was again endangered. "Stripped bare as we are here, it will be all we can do to prevent the enemy crossing the Potomac at Harper's Ferry, or above. If McDowell's force was now beyond our reach, we should be utterly helpless." Moreover, while Jackson and his forces made their way north, Lincoln reasoned, Richmond must be vulnerable. "I think the time is near when you must either attack Richmond or give up the job and come to the defense of Washington. Let me hear from you instantly." McClellan replied at 5 p.m., "Independently of it, the time is very near when I shall attack Richmond." He then haughtily informed his wife that he had just finished his reply to His Excellency, and complained, "It is perfectly sickening to deal with such people, and you may rest assured that I will lose as little time as possible in breaking off all connection with them. I get more sick of them every day, for every day brings with it only additional proofs of their hypocrisy, knavery, and folly." James McPherson concludes that Lincoln's diversion of McDowell's corps to chase Jackson was probably a strategic error, perhaps even the colossal blunder that McClellan considered it. For as soon as Jackson had managed to divert the Union forces bound for Richmond, he turned back southward to join in the defense of the Confederate capital. Still, McPherson adds, even if McDowell's corps had joined McClellan as planned, The latter's previous record offered little reason to believe that he would have moved with speed and boldness to capture Richmond. In the end, though McClellan had advanced to a position only 4 miles from Richmond by the end of May, he still refused to take the initiative, and his troops were surprised by a Confederate attack at Fair Oaks. Though the battle was inconclusive, and the rebels suffered heavier losses than the Union, McClellan was so devastated by the toll of nearly 5,000 Union dead and wounded that he lost whatever momentum he had created. McClellan keeps sending word that he will attack Richmond very soon, but every day brings some new excuse, reported Christopher Wolcott, Stanton's brother-in-law, now Assistant Secretary of War. The rain, a legitimate excuse during the first 10 days of June, had stopped 5 days earlier. Nevertheless, Wolcott noted, he has not stirred. McClellan's catalogue of gripes and concerns was endless. There were bridges to be built, bad roads, regiments to be reorganized. When Lincoln eventually ordered McDowell to reinforce him, the general continued to protest that, "If I cannot fully control all his, McDowell's, troops, I want none of them, but would prefer to fight the battle with what I have and let others be responsible for the results." Finally, he confided in his wife, "Utmost prudence was essential. I must not unnecessarily risk my life, for the fate of my army depends upon me, and they all know it." McClellan's chronic delays allowed General Lee to take the initiative once again. During the last week in June, the Confederates launched a brutal attack on Union forces that became known as the 7 Days Battles. The bloody series of engagements on the plains and in the swamps and forests surrounding the Chickahominy River left 1,734 Federals dead, 8,066 wounded, and 6,055 missing or captured. At the end of the first day's fighting, McClellan telegraphed Stanton to warn that he was up against vastly superior odds. He calculated that the rebels had 200,000 troops, when in fact they had fewer than half that figure. He would carry on without the reinforcements he had repeatedly requested, but, he continued, if his great inferiority in numbers caused a disaster, the responsibility cannot be thrown on my shoulders. It must rest where it belongs. Irked, Lincoln replied that McClellan's talk of responsibility pains me very much. I give you all I can, while you continue, ungenerously, I think, to assume that I could give you more if I would. As the fighting intensified in the days that followed, neither McClellan nor Lincoln was able to sleep. Success alternated between the two forces during the first 2 days. Then, on June 27th, the Confederates scored a critical victory at Gaines Mill, forcing McClellan to retreat. "I now know the full history of the day," McClellan telegraphed Stanton shortly after midnight. "I have lost this battle because my force was too small. I again repeat that I am not responsible for this. The President is wrong in regarding me as ungenerous. When I said that my force was too weak, I merely intimated a truth which today has been too plainly proved." Finally, he vindictively added, "If I save this army now, I tell you plainly that I owe no thanks to you or to any other persons in Washington. You have done your best to sacrifice this army." When the supervisor of telegrams at the War Department read this defiant message, he was so appalled by the insubordinate tone and the extraordinary charge against the government that he directed his staff to strike the last sentence before relaying it to Stanton. Even the revised telegram conveyed the accusation that would be leveled by McClellan and his supporters for years to come. Victory would have been achieved but for the government's failure to reinforce an overpowered McClellan. Even after the defeat at Gaines Mill, however, McClellan's troops remained a strong and resilient force. In the days that followed, they fought hard and well, inflicting more than 5,000 casualties at Malvern Hill, while suffering only half that number. In truth, McClellan was psychologically defeated. "He was simply out-generaled," Christopher Wolcott concluded. Instead of counterattacking, he continued to retreat from Richmond until his exhausted troops reached a safe position 8 miles down the James at Harrison's Landing. Equally depleted, Lee's troops returned to Richmond, and the Peninsula campaign came to an end. The Confederates had successfully secured their capital and gained an important strategic victory. It would take nearly 3 more years and hundreds of thousands more deaths for the Union forces to come as close to Richmond as they had been in May and June 1862. Chapter 17. We are in the depths. The defeat on the peninsula devastated Northern morale. "We are in the depths just now," George Templeton Strong admitted on July 14, 1862, "permeated by disgust, saturated with gloomy thinking." In Washington, columnist Kara Kaysen observed the frustration written on every face, manifesting an anxiety greater than the aftermath of Bull Run. "For the present repulse is more momentous." Count Gorofsky agreed, calling the 4th of July holiday "the gloomiest since the birth of this republic. Never was the country so low." Even the normally stoical John Nicolay confided to his fiancée, Thurina, that "the past has been a very blue week. I don't think I have ever heard more croaking since the war began." For the irrepressibly optimistic Seward, who had fervently hoped the capture of Richmond might signal an end to the war, the turn of events was shattering. It is a startling sight to see the mind of a great people saddened, angered, soured, all at once, he confided to Fanny, who was in Auburn with her mother for the summer. "If I should let a shade of this popular despondency fall upon a dispatch, or even rest upon my own countenance," he realized, "there would be black despair throughout the whole country." He begged her for letters detailing daily life at home, the flowers in bloom and the hatching of eggs, anything but war and defeat. "They bring no alarm, no remonstrances, no complaints, and no reproaches," he explained. "They are the only letters which come to me free from excitement. Write to me, then, cheerfully, as you are wont to do, of boys and girls and dogs and horses and birds that sing and stars that shine and never weep, and be blessed for all your days for thus helping to sustain a spirit." Chase was equally shaken and despondent. "Since the rebellion broke out, I have never been so sad," he told a friend. "We ought to have won a victory and taken Richmond." Furthermore, Kate, who had gone to Ohio to visit her grandmother, was not in Washington to console him. "The house seemed very dull after you were gone," he told her in one of many long letters cataloguing the events of that summer. He described his sojourn to see General McDowell, who had been knocked unconscious by a bad fall from his horse, told her of an unusual cabinet meeting, a pleasant dinner party at Seward's with the Stantons and the Wells, a meeting with J. Cook, and a visit from Bishop McIlvaine. He queried her about her summer clothes, her lace veil, and a diamond she had ordered. In addition to commonplace matters, he provided her with confidential military intelligence about the Peninsula campaign, delineating the flow of the Chickahominy and the position of the various divisions, so she could visualize the course of the battle. Kate was thrilled by her father's lengthy epistles, which she interpreted as a mark of love and confidence. Her appreciation, he replied, was more than ample reward.